You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, the European Commission presents concrete measures to remedy the migrants crisis. But will they enrage or calm the critics? My guests, Tim Marshall and Samira Shackle, are with me in the studio to discuss. And across the Atlantic, President Barack Obama's plan to shield millions of immigrants from deportation is dealt another setback. We ask whether his vision can ever win. Plus, we turn to the game that's become far from beautiful.
FIFA's president, as well as the Secretary General, are not involved in the allegations. I can't comment on the names mentioned in the media early this morning.
Tough times for FIFA after some of its key figures are arrested on corruption charges. But it says the news won't derail President Sepp Blatter's bid to win another term in office. We'll be talking about that and maybe a couple of other things here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tim Marshall, formerly diplomatic editor at Sky News, now the founder of thewhatandthewhy.com, and Samira Shackle, a London-based journalist and a regular contributor here on Monocle 24. Tim and Samira, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
In recent weeks here on Monocle 24, the death of migrants in the Mediterranean has been an all-too-frequent topic of discussion. Today, the European Commission put forward concrete measures to address that situation. Amongst them are proposals for a scheme to help Italy and Greece relocate some Syrian and Eritrean nationals in need of protection to other EU states. The measures also include an action plan against migrant smuggling and a recommendation asking members to resettle thousands of people from outside the European Union. Samira, I guess we should at least welcome the fact that there appears to be some sort of thought-out plan Europe-wide.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree with that. I think that it sort of has been... I think it's quite unrealistic that for people to think that there could be some sort of solution that didn't involve some sort of resettlement scheme, because I think so far we've seen EU plans to introduce the sort of naval force to tackle people smuggling gangs and so on, which could be one part of the plan, but it doesn't really stop the fact that people are still going to keep coming, and it doesn't address the huge humanitarian crises. So I think that any kind of action that acknowledges those humanitarian crises, while also acknowledging the disproportionate pressure on countries like Italy and Greece, and not only the disproportionate pressure on Italy and Greece, but also the sort of secondary humanitarian crisis happening in horrendous detention centres in Italy and Greece, and by people being sort of forced into like black market economies and travelling illegally across Europe. So I think it's good and sensible to have some sort of plan proposed to tackle that. But that said, it is a drop in the ocean, and there's still, despite the fact that it's a drop in the ocean, you know, it's, I think, proposing to settle 40,000 refugees over 2 years, which is great, but there were 600,000 last year alone, so it's a small percentage, and despite the fact it's a small percentage, partly probably to allay the fears of EU member states who are quite resistant to it, EU member states are still quite resistant to it.
Well, Tim, as Samira says, you know, it may be just 40,000 people here, but, you know, Hungary, Finland, here in the UK, these are countries where governments and let's be honest, populations are not necessarily going to agree.
It's the wrong plan at the right time. Of course something's got to be done. You know, the cry goes up, something must be done, and it's absolutely obvious. Immigration to the United Kingdom was 104,000 more than they were expecting last year. And that's just, you know, one country amongst the 28. The reason it's the wrong plan, severalfold. One, the 20,000 are only if you're Eritrean or Syrian. Well, who's going to fund who finds out? Every single person that comes from Africa, oh yeah, I'm Eritrean. Every person who wants to come across from an Arab country, yes, I'm Syrian. How are you going to police that? How are you going to find out who is and who isn't? That's the first big problem with it. The second is It could act as a pull. It could pull more people across
the
Mediterranean.
Do you think it really would? I mean, it's. I must say, whenever I've read stories or heard stories of people who have made that journey in the first place to get as far as Libya, very few of them are willing to. You know, if they fully know the risks, they may not even get across the water in the first place. They're prepared to die to get out of the country.
I'm not convinced that they are fully conversant with the risks and what may await them in the camps. When they reach places like Italy and Greece, I'm really not convinced by that, and I wish that a lot more money was put into advertising in those countries to say this is the reality of the journey you might want to take.
But if they were if they're not aware of the risks they would face, then why would they then be aware of the possible benefits that they would face? Do you see what I mean? It sort of cuts both ways, I think.
Because the streets are paved with gold, except they're not.
But by that token, people have that faith anyway, if that's your argument, and therefore it wouldn't make a difference if you're going to treat them humanely or not when they get there, because that's what they're assuming anyway by your logic. But I'm not sure I totally agree, because I think sort of various studies over the course of many years have shown that it spikes in asylum applications from certain countries, spikes in immigration, not sort of economic migration.
Are related to the situation in the country, violence.
That's something that's very consistently shown by statistics. So I'm just not convinced that pull factors really exist in the way that our government argues they do.
We disagree on that. Another reason why I don't think it's a particularly good idea is that Mr. Juncker, the European Commission head, yet again has got his head in the sand and is refusing to understand that if he tries to take sovereignty away from the nations by saying, you're going to take this many, you're going to take that many, you're going to take that many, as opposed to a country saying, this is how many we will take, if you take that sovereignty away, you are playing into the hands of all the right-wing parties. Why do we think the right-wing parties are rising and will continue to rise across the continent? It is because, partially, of ill-thought-out policies like this. Now, the Hungarians have got an extremely right-wing government. If you want to cement that extreme right-wing government in place, put this plan into place. I don't think many of the nation states will go for it. I'm not sure it'll get through. If it does, I'm not sure it's workable. Well, the only thing that we agree on is that absolutely something has to be done to address the problems, both of stopping the people smugglers, but also trying to sort out the situations in the country from where people are coming.
We'll come on to that point in a moment, because I think it's one that hasn't really been talked about enough. But on this issue of, you know, the idea of the European Commission forcing a plan on the member states have to agree to this. As you say, many of them, you know, may well not. Surely, you know, that is the only way that the European Union can deal with it. It can say, look, here's a plan, here's what we would like everyone to do. And if a country doesn't want to sign up to it, then it doesn't have to.
Well, no, yeah, and the UK, Ireland and Denmark don't have to, because they've already got opt-ins and opt-outs. I think the Spanish are very likely to vote against this. I think the French may well vote against it. And if you get, I think it's 35% of the population of the EU represented by at least four countries, at that point, the motion fails. So why is Mr. Juncker and the Commission seeking this confrontation instead of seeking a way where the nation states and the Commission and the EU can all work together?
Samira Shackle, have we seen nation states, actually individual nation states, come forward and say, yes, we are willing to take people?
I'm not sure about this proposal, because it's been very recently announced, but I think over the last few years we've seen, for instance, Germany and Sweden being quite willing to take in much larger numbers of Syrian refugees than any other European countries have.
Sweden offered to take 100,000 Syrian refugees.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas here in the UK we're talking the low hundreds.
It's sort of under 200, I think. But then and Germany, I think, took 10,000 and then upped it again. So I think that one of the main arguments that sort of put forward against this is that, you know, the governments are under strain and there's anti-immigration sentiment among populations, etc. But I just sort of can't see, even if that is your view, that we've got too much immigration, etc. I just can't see that some sort of temporary resettlement program which keeps people within the system isn't appealing even to those people who argue that. But because you have the fact of it is hundreds of thousands of people flowing into the continent, many of whom are those who don't get trapped in horrible internment camps, many of whom are making illegal journeys across Europe and are entering those economies illegally. So why then, for a government that wants to control immigration, would you not bring those people into the system, keep track of them, give them a temporary status and sort of keep control of it that way?
Tim, I want to go back to something you touched on just before about the source, you know, the original problems here. You know, these are people who are coming from countries with huge problems, whether that is Syria and its civil war, or whether that is Eritrea, a horrendous dictatorship, which is essentially a prison where if it's illegal to leave. If you want to leave, you'll be shot at by border guards. Now, I know political reform in Eritrea isn't the sexiest phrase, but why is no one actually talking about political reform in Eritrea?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that, and part of it is the cultural cringe which the Europeans have because of the heinous crimes they committed during colonialism. And we're still not over it. And we don't like to dictate to other people and tell them what to do and say, for example, we're going to link all our aid to your reforms. That is considered by the people receiving the aid to be the old European colonists telling us what we can and can't do. And it goes down very badly. But I think it should be.
But linked. Actually, no, but that's not true. Aid that the European Union and the UK and the US have given
partially,
has been linked to issues over corruption.
It's partially linked.
Lots of aid doesn't go to governments now. It goes to certain departments.
Yes, it's different in each country, but I think there should be more. By the way, for the record, I think there should be more immigration to this country. And I'm not arguing from a standpoint of being anti-immigration. I think there should be more immigration. I just don't think that the chaotic way people are flooding in is, and forgive me for using that emotive term, is benefiting the different societies that people are coming to. I think we are putting the foundations in for some serious, serious trouble. I mean, the European continent has a very long history of extreme political parties, and I think we're running the risk of entering back into that age, and then you really will see the trouble, and the racism that immigrants currently suffer will be quadrupled.
Samira, to go back to this issue of what's happening in the countries where people are coming from, there's not just the lack of any interest in the situation in Eritrea. There's also a startling lack of interest in the political talks led by the UN on the situation in Libya, a country which the West was very interested in 4 years ago and then seems to have walked away from. Do you sense that that is, there is any chance of that changing in the coming months?
It's really difficult to say when you have proposals that are tabled are things like, well, we're just going to take the Navy in and tackle the people smugglers, which I think is quite simplistic because, you blow up the boats, people can get more boats, essentially, to put it very simply. I think that what we've seen over the past at least 5 years, if not more, is this sort of period of really pulling back from any kind of intervention in the world after a period of gross over-intervention. And I think there's this real sort of squeamishness about what to do and whether things will just make it worse, which the Libya situation is a case in point. That our involvement there was really hailed as a new kind of intervention. It's very targeted, it's great, and then it's just ended in absolute anarchy with the same kind of failure to plan for a post-conflict situation as you saw in Iraq. So it's sort of trying to avoid repeating crimes, but in fact sort of repeating some of the less obvious ones. So I think that it's certainly true. I don't think we can expect to stem the flow of migrants without tackling the fact that there is a situation of anarchy and a complete failure of the state in Libya. But I don't know if the government has the political will to do anything about it.
And it seems, Tim Osher, that it's been the Libya diplomatic process seems to have been completely delinked from this migration crisis. It's as if one has no consequence on the other.
They are now trying to link the two, but unsuccessfully. And I agree with everything Samira said. The The post-war planning in Iraq was the Americans' fault and was absolutely disgraceful. The post-war planning in Libya was the Europeans' fault and was non-existent. However, had they put a stabilisation force in of, say, 100,000 troops that then began to get shot at and it became another Libya, Iraq, it would have done. The same people that are now saying, what a mess, would be saying, oh, you're a colonial institution, you've got to get out of that your occupiers. You know, you cannot win, but what you should do is, before you make your decisions, make sure you've got a backup plan, and in neither Iraq or Libya does there appear to have been a backup plan.
We're going to stay on the theme of migration, but cross this time to the United States, where US President Barack Obama faces yet another setback. His plan to shield millions of undocumented immigrants from being deported has been somewhat stunted after an appeals court refused to lift a block put in place by 26 states that said the president had overstepped his authority. By a 2-1 vote, judges ruled that Obama's action should stay on hold pending further proceedings. Samira Shackle, President Barack Obama has talked about immigration reform for a very long time and tried to get a bipartisan bill through, originally through the Senate during his first term. And at the start of his second term, he basically said, right, I've tried working with you guys. It's gone nowhere. I'm going to take executive action, do what I can. There were always going to be limits to that executive action. And he's come up against more limits now.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I guess the executive power, that's the benefit of being US president, even if you're ruling in a completely untenable situation, as Obama is. But, you know, once again, on I think immigration, wherever you are in the world, whether you're in Europe or whether you're in America, wherever you are, and particularly if you're in a sort of wealthy nation that people want to immigrate to, it's always going to be a very, very tense subject, particularly at times of economic austerity when people are sort of more inclined to be anti-immigration anyway. And I think in the US, particularly when you're a president ruling in an incredibly partisan atmosphere with a Republican Party who just sort of want his scalp, essentially. So I think that this was never going to be an easy thing to tackle. But I think the principle is quite similar in a way to what we were just, some of the issues we've just been touching on, which is the fact that for those people who don't want to see these migrants brought into the system, etc., I don't really know what they're proposing as an alternative, because those people are there. So you might, by giving them, I think Obama's not proposing to give anyone full citizenship. He's proposing temporary 3-year work visas, which would allow people, many of whom have been living there for decades or certainly years, would allow those people to pay taxes, bring them in a time when the country desperately needs more taxes. So I don't really see, it just seems like very sensible policymaking to me.
And yet, Tim Marshall, if you go back to the aftermath of the 2012 election, you had a number of prominent Republicans or Republican personalities, even Sean Hannity on Fox News, saying, my views on immigration have evolved. They realised that they were losing the Hispanic vote, and the only way they were going to get into power was if they won that back somehow. So they realised they had to tamp down the rhetoric on immigration. It hasn't lasted long, though, has it?
Hasn't lasted long at all, and that's because we're approaching the next presidential election, and it's going to be one of the issues. And if you look at the legal time frame, yes, he has had the executive order, but the Court of Appeal down in, New Orleans said, no, we reject your executive order. Now it goes, he has to appeal against that. If he doesn't win that, he has to go to the Supreme Court. And by that time, we've got an election, in which case Hillary better make her mind up, and she's with him on this. And I agree with Samira. It seems to me an inherently sensible policy. And the Republicans will make hay out of it. I was in Arizona a couple of years back, and it's a huge issue there because it is close to Mexico and this is a Hispanic issue. But I think this is entirely political. You mentioned, Samira, that yes, that's the benefit of having executive order, but the benefit of the US Constitution is that 26 of the states of the 50 said, we don't like this. And that plays back into internal politics in each individual state, just like the member nation states in Europe, it plays into their politics. The 26 states know that they might lose some votes from the Republicans if they go for this. And so they're opposing it. And all politics is local. And you're right, the Republicans did seem to wake up and realize that their future will just dwindle and vanish unless they embrace the Hispanic vote. But the emotion has got hold of them, and they're not going to.
Tim, do you think that since the Republicans are going to have two prominent Hispanic candidates, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, have declared their candidacies, that might change somewhat the rhetoric, possibly even the views of the Republican establishment when it comes to choosing a presidential candidate and choosing a policy?
Yes, until the candidate is chosen. You know, they drop out one by one. Now, if Cruz is saying X and it's going down well and Jeb Bush realises he's got a tack to the left, he'll make the right noises until the point comes when, if he's the candidate, and then he'll tack to the right. I mean, you know, people blow with the wind when they're trying to get elected. I mean, it's about a much, much bigger issue, this, about where America is going. And we all know that in the southern states, by, I think it's about 2024, no, 2020, Texas becomes... white people are not a majority anymore. And that pattern will be repeated throughout the Southwest. And you've got to get on board with the people who are going to be voting for you. And the Republicans are behind the curve.
It certainly, Samira, seems to be different in the US to Europe, where here the rhetoric certainly about immigration is mainly anti. Even the mainstream parties are trying to find a way to sound tough, always sounding tough. Whereas in the US, you do have a situation where Hillary Clinton, who's probably going to be the Democratic nominee, is probably going to strike quite a pro-migrant tone. And it's possible that might well help her electorally.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that. And I think it comes down to the fact that you've got such a big proportion of the population is Hispanic or prominent, you know, and that's the old sort of stereotype that America's a nation of migrants, which is true, I think, still. And you see that in the fact that you have huge voting blocks who are from these communities and would like to see sort of the kind of sensible policymaking that we're talking about. And I think Obama's described this as the situation with all the undocumented migrants as a humanitarian crisis within America.
We'll leave it there just for now. Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall, thank you very much. In a moment, we'll be talking football.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and still with me in the studio, Tim Marshall and Samira Shackle. Now, two investigations are underway into corruption at football's world governing body, FIFA, with seven top officials among a larger group indicted on corruption charges in a US inquiry, arrested this morning in a very posh, plush Zurich hotel. The US Department of Justice is leading that corruption investigation. Sepp Blatter, FIFA's head since 1998, was not among those arrested. In addition to that investigation, a second criminal case has been launched by Swiss prosecutors into the bids for the next two World Cups set for Russia and Qatar. And it's worth, Tim Marshall, starting with a quote from Loretta Lynch, the US Attorney General, from her astonishing press conference today. She said, "The indictment alleges corruption that is rampant, systemic and deep-rooted both abroad and here in the United States. It spans at least two generations of soccer officials who, as alleged, have abused their positions of trust to acquire millions of dollars in bribes and kickbacks." I mean, this is, you know, we've talked about corruption and allegations of corruption in FIFA and in football for many, many years, but somehow the organisation has rumbled on like a ship that you can't possibly knock off course.
By investigating itself every single time. Oh, and every single time they say, good heavens, is this really happening inside our organisation? We really must do something about
shocked,
it.
Shocked, I tell you.
Exactly. And then they do very, very little. Hallelujah. Honestly, I mean, you and I are both huge football fans, and I don't know a single football fan anywhere in the world that has anything good to say about FIFA. It is an unpleasant organisation. many of the people inside it are unpleasant. I can't make allegations here about bribery and corruption. I don't have the evidence. I do agree with that fine footballer, Gary Lineker, who was played for England and is currently on British television. He tweeted, there can't be a more corrupt, deplorable organisation on earth than FIFA. Well, I think Pyongyang in North Korea, you know, you can make arguments, or perhaps Zimbabwe. Nevertheless, I know what he's getting at. All football fans will be pleased. It'll be a film one day. I see George Clooney as the chief investigator, because look at what they did. The FBI put this together in the States with the Swiss authorities and the US authorities, raided other places at the same time, closed down all the bank accounts. These guys were now facing extradition. I mean, it's a fantastic story. You don't have to be interested in football to think this is the story of the day, even if it's not the most important story.
And also, I must say, the fact that the part of the investigation turned on getting a senior US football official done for, who's accused of not declaring millions of dollars which he hadn't paid tax on, and getting him to then go into a hotel room and bug his colleagues. That football official, if you had to name a US football official, could you come up with a better name than Chuck Blazer? There we are. Samira, this isn't just about football. This is a story about power and greed and corruption. And as Tim says, you know, these allegations have been going along for a while, but FIFA somehow has been unscathed. Do you think that they can remain unscathed?
It's really difficult to imagine, isn't it? But they, as Tim rightly says, they just seem to have powered through in the past. And I think it's quite amazing that, you know, these allegations stretch back since 1990, I think. You know, it's a huge amounts of money. And while there are no direct charges against Sepp Blatter, he was in control for most of that time. He's been the president since 1998. So
a bit like some of those dictators in various countries around the world. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Yeah.
President for life, that sort of thing.
But then it's amazing to think that, you know, that FIFA's brief statement today, just that, well, he's the presidential election are going to go ahead. It's got nothing to do with him, whatever. And you think, if, you know, for that to happen when someone's at the helm in any other company, it's very hard to imagine the president not falling on their sword.
But that's the problem, Tim, isn't it? Because it's not like any other company. It's that the president of FIFA is chosen by the heads of 209 football associations around the world, which are themselves, let's face it, many of them not the most palatable of organisations. You could almost go as far as say it's a democracy of dictatorships.
I think very much so it is. And I also think that the chickens are coming home to roost. I think it is going to crumble. I don't see how the organisation in its current form can survive if the allegations against those who have been charged are found. It's on Friday, isn't it? The voting for the president. And there's only two candidates, one of whom's Blatter. Blatter's going to come out and say, I'm shocked, I tell you, about these terrible accusations. I'm the right man to lead us into the new era. I just think that even if he does win, it's beginning to crumble.
Perhaps, but Samira Shackle, there was a very good piece at the weekend by Simon Cooper in the Financial Times, who pointed out the genius, as he put it, of Sepp Blatter, which was to realise the West doesn't matter, that he's managed to garner votes from Africa, from Asia, from the Middle East, from, as we've seen today, from the Caribbean, where he can have 20 votes, one of which is from the Cayman Islands, which matters just as much as the one vote from Germany.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's certainly true. And I think that one of the things, just coming back to what Tim was saying earlier about the film adaptation, I think it will be an amazing film adaptation at some point. Even the fact that the agents were going in plain clothes into the getting the hotel number, hotel room numbers, and walking.
They all turned up this morning at the hotel, asked the concierge for the room numbers.
It just sort of swooped.
And I must say, I did like the way that, you know, a Swiss hotel doorman always goes the extra mile, holding out sheets to protect the guests as they came out
from the cameras.
Put into the cars.
Isn't it? I think one of the reasons it's such a big story, even, you know, outside those who are interested in football, is partly just the I think that it's quite unusual for us to see stories about the rich and powerful getting their comeuppance, you know, that kind of thing. You've got an organisation that's been dogged by allegations of corruption for years and has thus far been able to get away with just investigating itself and sort of whitewashing the whole thing.
Can you imagine what's going to come out? It's not just about these officials. Who did they talk to? Who did they talk to in broadcasting? Who did they talk to in the football associations around the world? You know, it's not just these guys that are going to be looked at closely. Mm.
We'll have to leave it there. Tim Marshall and Samira Shackle, thank you both very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Moneta. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Tom Edwards is here next. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Giacopelli at 1900 Hours. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.